Hello from Patricia Glynn and Storycatcher. Good to have you with us for the last episode of Storycatcher for 2025. We're ending on a high note with part two of Professor Francis Thackeray's investigation into a mystery surrounding William Shakespeare. For a couple of centuries or more, there's been a rumour that the bard's grave was ransacked and his skull stolen. And there've also been rumours that it wasn't Shakespeare's grave that was robbed, but his wife, Anne's. Either way, what happened to that skull? Well, the rumours have been particularly energetic on the matter, and because Francis is an experienced paleoanthropologist, he has made significant progress in solving the mystery. In fact, it's a groundbreaking contribution to this deeply intriguing matter. We covered some of the basic aspects of the story in part one of our chat, and I would suggest that you listen to that before you continue listening. But if you don't, you will get the gist of things because Francis is very skilled at weaving in a précis of what we learned the last time as he goes along.
It's known from two articles in the magazine called Argosy that the skull attributed to William Shakespeare was stolen and got taken eventually to a church called St. Leonard's near Bearley in Worcestershire. We would call it a legend. Published in 1879 initially, a story of the theft of the skull attributed to William Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. So the Argosy magazine publishes two articles. One is called How Shakespeare's Skull Was Stolen About 1794. That article was published only in 1879. It was followed 5 years later in 1884 by an article called How Shakespeare's Skull Was Lost and Found. Now this is a really interesting story. There's a dinner at Ragley Hall near St. Leonard's Church in Bearley. And during the course of the dinner, there's reference to Horace Walpole, a member of Parliament, who had offered £300 to anybody who could rob the grave of William Shakespeare and remove his skull.
There was a mistaken theory at the time that insights into human brains could be gleaned through the study of skulls. This odd and now discredited theory was called phrenology. It claimed that enlargements or depressions on a skull, its lumps and bumps and size, could be linked to specific mental functions, including intelligence. It would seem possible that Horace Walpole and his cohorts wanted Shakespeare's skull for this reason. After all, you don't get anyone much smarter than William Shakespeare.
So he was offering £300 to anyone who would steal the skull. Now, a person attending that dinner was a Dr. Frank Chambers. He was a medical doctor. It's also known that he lived near a churchyard, and he admits in the story from 1794 that he himself was a grave robber. In the interests of science, he was robbing bodies for anatomists for dissection. Absolutely, bodies were dissected by students in about 1794, even as early as that. Even earlier, in the days of Michelangelo and Leonardo da Vinci, bodies were stolen from the graves. Well, here's a medical doctor, Dr. Frank Chambers, who is known to be a grave robber in the interest of science. So he's attending this dinner. And during the course of the dinner, there's mention of Horace Walpole offering £300. So Dr. Frank Chambers goes home, thinks about it, and says, right, I'm going to do it. And he gets three young, strong men, illiterate, including one Tom Dyers, And they go off in the night to Holy Trinity Church near Stratford, or in Stratford upon Avon. And with picks and shovels, they dig. They remove the tombstone attributed to William Shakespeare with a curse. Cursed be he who moves my bones. And they get as far as a skull. And Dr. Frank Chambers nurtures it in his hands. He goes home and then he writes to Horace Walpole and says, right, I've got it. Will you please give me £300? Now, Horace Walpole lives in London in a mansion that he's built for himself. Horace Walpole is extremely wealthy in 1794. And he actually is reluctant to give £300 to Dr. Frank Chambers. Well, to cut a long story short, eventually Dr. Frank Chambers is told that Walpole only wants it on loan. Frank Chambers is upset. And then he tries to sell it to somebody else for less than £300. Well, the sale doesn't go through. And unfortunately, Dr. Frank Chambers is left with it. But there's someone who says to Frank Chambers, goodness gracious me, you've dug up the skull and there's a curse associated. Yes. You jolly well put it back. Put it back. So Dr. Frank Chambers gives instructions to Tom Dyer, the illiterate strong man, to return the skull to Holy Trinity Church in Stratford upon Avon. So Thomas goes off, but then decides not to return it to Holy Trinity Church. Instead, he's going to put it in another church in Worcestershire called St. Leonard's Church. Dr. Frank Chambers in 1794 is led to believe that the skull has been returned, but it's actually in Worcestershire, not in Stratford upon Avon. Okay, now we have to jump forward to 1879.
Before we do that, was some kind of curse visited on any of these four men?
As far as I know, there was no curse placed on these four men. They simply died and they were lost to history. Nobody knew about them after they'd died. There was no curse subjected. So we now have to jump forward to 1879, which is the year in which an article was published in the magazine called Argosy.
This is 100 years later.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And the first article is called How Shakespeare's Skull Was Stolen About 1794. And the article was written anonymously by a person who calls himself a Warwickshire man. Stratford-upon-Avon is the town in Warwickshire. And he makes use of documents from Dr. Frank Chambers. So we have to recognise that Frank Chambers is the source of information and the author, a Warwickshire man, makes use of those documents. Well, there was a lot of interest in this article published in 1879 from America, from Germany. They said, please give us more information. What happened? We want to know. So 5 years later, in 1884, a second article comes out called How Shakespeare's Skull Was Lost and Found. And this time we know that the author is the Reverend Charles Langston, who is none other than the vicar of St. Leonard's Church, which is indeed the church where a skull has been put in a crypt, and it's been there since 1884, and even earlier if we were to believe the account given in 1884.
So it's in this crypt.
The crypt is underground.
And in the side of the crypt nestles this skull.
And that is where it is to this very day. Now, what happened in 2016, a forensic study was undertaken on the skull attributed to Shakespeare in St. Leonard's Church in Bearley. The forensic study was undertaken by Dr. Caroline Wilkinson from Liverpool John Moores University. And remarkably, she came to the conclusion that this skull attributed to William Shakespeare was actually female, and that this female was 70 years old. So there was no way that this skull attributed to Shakespeare could have been William himself. Now, that's really interesting because Anne Hathaway, the wife of William Shakespeare, died when she was about 70 years old. And she was buried next to William. I have the hunch that the tombstones were muddled up.
And if the tombstones were swapped by accident, perhaps during renovations, there's a possibility that the skull at Bearley is that of Anne Hathaway. Proving this hypothesis, and he's quick to say that this is merely a hypothesis, has occupied Francis Thackeray's mind for a good few years. Caroline Wilkinson's reconstruction is of some help here, but there's a limit to the details which facial reconstruction can offer. Some say it's as much an art as it is a science, and things like hair and eye colour, skin thickness, wrinkles and so on are left to the subjective interpretation and imagination of the reconstructor.
Professor Wilkinson's work on that skull does indeed reveal the face of an elderly woman. A woman, may I say, who's been through quite a few trials and tribulations. She's got quite a haggard face. And it doesn't look anything like the portraits of Anne Hathaway.
You're absolutely right. Totally different from the portraits of Anne Hathaway.
And wide-mouthed, whereas the portraits show a little rosebud mouth. That might be a convention of the time.
Well, let me say that the portrait that I'm interested in was undertaken in 2010 based on a portrait that was sketched by Nathaniel Curzon in the 1700s, allegedly based on a portrait, which is now missing, from the 1600s, early 1600s. Now, I've been very interested in the comparison between the portrait and the skull from St. Leonard's Church. Now, Eddie Odes did an overlay.
Who is Eddie Odes?
Eddie Odes is a colleague of mine. He's an anatomist, and he did a study of teeth of Australopithecus sediba. So he's a paleoanthropologist, and he's also an artist. And when I approached him and I said, please, could you use your skills, especially with photographic techniques, to do an overlay between the portrait of Anne and the skull of the person whose skull was taken to St. Leonard's. We did the overlay, and there's a remarkable correspondence. I like to use the word remarkable.
Well, to lay people like me, it's uncanny. It's absolutely uncanny because it has this particular shape, the high forehead, and it slots beautifully onto this portrait.
There's a good correspondence, a remarkable correspondence.
Nonetheless, as Francis has just told us, the Roger Bryan Dunn portrait of 2010 was based on a sketch done by Nathaniel Curzon in 1708, which in turn was based on sketches of Anne from the early 1600s. That's 400 years worth of possible artistic license brought to bear in the portrayal of her features, albeit unwittingly. But Francis is confident that the Dunn portrait could be a reliable representation of Anne.
So the next step then is what? Should you not now go through the whole process of getting access to that skull?
Well, it would really be nice to get access to the Bearley skull. However, we know that attempts were made in 2015 to have it studied for radiocarbon dating. We don't know how old it is. So a proposal was put in to the church representatives in Worcestershire, and it was declined. to have it radiocarbon dated, to have it analysed. Permission was not given for the skull to be taken out of the crypt. There it is, in a niche, but permission was given for the laser surface scanning. They put in an arm, it was called a Pharaoh arm, for laser surface scanning. That was permitted, but the skull was not to be touched, it was not to be moved.
So this is, for now then, a dead end, but surely, Francis, I mean, you're a specialist in DNA and all of that. Surely there's a way of proving who is lying beneath grave 2 and who is lying beneath grave 1. Who is William Shakespeare?
Okay, now I'd like to turn to what we call a thought experiment. We know that even Albert Einstein conducted thought experiments. He even chased atoms in his mind. It was a thought experiment. He knew he couldn't actually do it. He knew he couldn't do it, but he performed it in his mind. Albert Einstein had a fantastic brain, and he undertook these thought experiments. Well, likewise, we can conduct thought experiments with regard to the skulls and skeletons in Holy Trinity Church and at St. Leonard's Church in Bearley in England. I have sat in my thinking chair and conducted thought experiments. The first part of the thought experiment was, please, can we excavate person number 2 in the second position attributed to William Shakespeare? We know from the Church of England that the answer is certainly not. However, let's think about person number 1 buried in the first position, whom I believe is William Shakespeare. How can we possibly know if this first person, person number 1, is William Shakespeare? Well, we apply to the Church of England to exhume person 1. For goodness sake, one thing we would do is to analyse the DNA. We would take a small sample of bone, or for that matter, a small sample of tooth enamel, a small sample of dentine. So in our thought experiment, yes, we will exhume that body. We will establish the DNA. And wouldn't that be wonderful to have the DNA of William Shakespeare, as I would see it? But we would have to establish, is it William Shakespeare? Now, as part of the thought experiment, we look at descendants, not of William Shakespeare, because he left no male offspring, but we would look at the descendants of the grandfather of William Shakespeare. The grandfather of William was Richard. Richard Shakespeare, and he lived between 1512 and 1583. He had a son, Matthew, who had a son, Thomas, leading to John, leading to Jonathan, leading to John, leading, eventually to 2 children. One is Henry Davenport Shakespeare, a male, and a female, Mary Ann Shakespeare. And just by the way, I'm a direct descendant of Mary Ann Shakespeare. She was my great-great-grandmother. She had this brother, Henry Davenport Shakespeare, on the male part of the lineage. He was the father of Henry John Child Shakespeare, whose son Francis Shakespeare went to India. And I'm particularly interested in that Francis Shakespeare, who is a direct descendant of Richard Shakespeare, the grandfather. And we know that the DNA of that Francis Shakespeare would have been the same as the DNA, the Y DNA for males of Richard, who was born in 1512. Francis Shakespeare was born in 1864. They would have the same male Y DNA. Now that would be phenomenal, because Richard Shakespeare's Y DNA would be identical to that of William Shakespeare. Francis Shakespeare, buried in India, he died at the age of 40 years, Sadly, he suffered a stroke in northern India, a remote part of northern India. He was a captain in a military division. He was buried in Prayagraj in Uttar Pradesh, a remote region of northern India. It's a very simple grave. I've seen a photograph of it. It's online. And there's simply a stone rectangle indicating the outline of the grave. There's a marble cross. His name is on it. We know it's Francis Shakespeare, who lived between 1864 and 1905. So as part of my thought experiment, we analyse his bones, his teeth, and we get his DNA, the Y chromosome, which would be identical to that of Richard Shakespeare, his great-great-great-dot-dot-dot-dot-grandfather. We know that Richard Shakespeare had a grandson on a separate male lineage leading to William. So by analysing the DNA of Francis Shakespeare, whose body lies in northern India, we would have the signature for William. That's a very important part of the information. Because if secondly, we could also analyse the DNA of person number one, and if there was correspondence, we would know that person one is William.
Yep, and that the gravestones were swapped. And the person who lost the skull was poor old Anne.
Perhaps. And of course, if we wanted to prove that Anne's head was in that crypt, the easiest thing to do, in a thought experiment, of course, would be to exhume the remains of the person in position number 5 in the row of Shakespeare's extended family in Holy Trinity Church, Stratford-upon-Avon. That was Anne and William's daughter, Susanna Hall, and to analyse her DNA, her mitochondrial DNA, to test if there was a relationship between mother and daughter, as expected in the thought experiment. But as you heard, the Church of England will not allow any exhumations of bodies, at least for now. Incidentally, I gather from Francis that exhuming a body in Uttar Pradesh in India is, if anything, more challenging than doing so in England. So a thought experiment that shall remain too, for now. But, you know, we live in the age of optic fibre probes and operations remotely conducted by robots. So perhaps the technology will emerge that makes it possible for a probe to be inserted into a grave without the need for a complete exhumation. And this would be easy to do because it's believed that Shakespeare and others in Holy Trinity Church were buried in simple shrouds, not in coffins. I like to think that the bard would approve of thought experiments, in his mind's eye, to quote from Hamlet, and I don't doubt he'd welcome Francis and his colleagues being able to establish whether or not the skull at Bewley is that of his dear wife. If you'd like to read about Francis's work on the Shakespeare skull mystery, please take a look at my blog's page. Francis has written a more detailed and academic version of the story with photographs and illustrations, and it dovetails very nicely with our chat. And so be it. Goodbye from Patricia Glynn, from the amazing Amy, my editor, Gus Doyle, who handles my website, and the newcomer to the team, Michaela Late, who is in charge of my social media. These folk are part-time, so they work fast and efficiently and at cut rates, and I'm tremendously lucky to have them pulling for Storycatcher. Just as I'm tremendously lucky to have you listening to our podcast in increasing numbers from around the world, may I say. In the main, that's thanks to our knowledgeable and big-hearted guests who have been, without exception, enthusiastic about contributing to Storycatcher. I thank them all so very much. It's not been an easy season because, as you know, if you're a regular, I had one issue after another with my beloved truck, Alexandra. Not altogether her fault. In essence, I think I have to acknowledge that a 6-tonner is now just too big for me. And I have decided to downscale. So Big L is on the market, and when I've got the funds from her, I'll buy something nippy and zippy with which I'll launch our next season of Storycatcher. My old girl Tina and newbie dogs Taka and Thomas will, needless to say, be with me, and we'll explore the byways of Southern Africa, catching the stories that define us. Please keep your suggestions coming via our social media platforms and website, storycatcher.co.za. Goodbye for now.